dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Because I have the opportunity to talk to you on the radio each week and decide what to communicate to you based on what I think is important, I'm in a pitifully small group of people in this nation who are actually able to fully exercise their hypothetical right of freedom of speech. Freedom to speak means little if those you want to address can't hear you. The sequestration of most of the broadcast media under corporate control has resulted in making it almost impossible to have widespread and accessible public discourse that honestly examines social problems and solutions. It seems that the less freedom we have, the more clamorous and repetitive the official voices become in telling us that we live in the freest country in the world. This assertion is adamantly defended by people who apparently know little about what happens elsewhere. The fact is that the freedoms available to average citizens are roughly equivalent in any of the so-called first world democracies, and the freedoms available are insufficient. Many of those nations, however, do provide their populations with benefits not enjoyed here, such as free health care, a minimum of 4 weeks' vacation each year, or proportional representation in elections which fosters the existence of multiple political parties instead of two, both dominated by corporations. And even these basic benefits are under corporate attack on a global level through the vehicle of so-called free trade treaties. None of these so-called democracies provide equal freedom to all their citizens. While these freedoms exist on paper, the reality is that they must be purchased, and the extent to which one can meaningfully experience these freedoms is related to one's financial position. The economics of the market is the de facto governmental structure that determines how free one actually is, and sets the limits on the amount of freedom and dignity available to an individual. It's surprising to me that many of the people who don't benefit very much from this arrangement staunchly defend it, and suggest that critics should either leave or be silent. Or they may point out how miserable life is in most of the rest of the world's nations where there is even less freedom, as if one should be delighted to have a broken leg because it's not two broken legs. They sometimes express being grateful for the freedoms they enjoy as Americans. Any freedoms we have as Americans were struggled for against our own government and the powers behind that throne. They were not gifts to be grateful for. That is, if one believes the words of the Declaration of Independence with respect to inalienable rights. These freedoms were not won on foreign soil against people of other nations. Our freedoms have come from revolution, civil war, strikes, riots, and protest against others in our own society, including the sacred founding fathers. Much blood has been shed in these battles, with often the only uniforms in sight being those worn by the police or the National Guard, as the full might of the state was used to squash any attempt seen as fundamentally challenging an economic and social system that is basically a giant multi-level marketing scheme. Carl Estabrook of the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana explained these relations clearly and succinctly in an article, Democracy or Corporations, Meditations from Chomsky, published last winter in the Counterpunch newsletter. He wrote, As I was saying before I was so strangely interrupted, there's not much place for democracy in modern America. What elements of democracy exist are trammeled up by corporate control. It's even more true now than it was when American philosopher John Dewey observed 80 years ago that politics is the shadow cast on society by big business, and therefore, attenuation of the shadow will not change the substance. Dewey meant that political reforms don't make much difference if business domination remains in place. Power today, he wrote, resides in control of the means of production, exchange, publicity, transportation, and communication. Whoever owns them rules the life of the country, even if democratic forms remain. Business for private profit through private control of banking, land, industry, reinforced by command of the press, press agents, and other means of publicity and propaganda, that is the actual system of power, the source of coercion and control, and until it's unraveled, we can't talk seriously about democracy and freedom. Close quote. Democracy and capitalism are, of course, contradictory, because democracy is egalitarian, and capitalism depends upon inequality. Democracy means one person, one vote, even as the Supreme Court recognizes in theory, while capitalism requires a majority who must rent their talents of head or hands to another, much smaller group, who are said to have a peculiar relationship, ownership, to the fields and factories necessary to produce food, shelter, and whatever other commodities they wish. The history of democracy is that it is always opposed by political and economic structures designed to, quote, protect the minority of the opulent against the majority, close quote, the goal of the U.S. Constitution, according to its principal author. We have the forms of political democracy in this country, if rarely the substance. But we don't even have the forms of economic democracy. Crucial economic decisions, such as what society should make or build, and consequently what jobs are available, are in the private hands of the boards of directors of major corporations. We take this undemocratic control for granted, with the thought that there is no other way. The 20th century has been characterized by three developments of great political importance, wrote Alex Carey: the growth of democracy, the growth of corporate power, and the growth of corporate propaganda as a means of protecting corporate power against democracy. Close quote. In the U.S. each year, more than $1 trillion, almost 20% of the total worth of goods and services produced in the country, is spent in a quite conscious campaign called marketing to teach you that you should be a docile employee or student, a sort of trainee employee, and an isolated consumer, sitting by yourself in front of the TV or computer screen, except when you're at work, when you might do the same thing. That it's probably a little dangerous to have much to do with those around you, except when you're out establishing your own rather exploitative relationships. And that in fact no other way to live is possible. A now forgotten German social scientist remarked at the dawn of the capitalist age, according to Adam Smith, society is a commercial enterprise. Every one of its members is a salesman. It is evident how political economy establishes an alienated form of social intercourse as the true and original form, and that which corresponds to human nature. Close quote. The subtle but quite effective limitations on democracy were brought home to me in the recent election campaign, in which I was the Green Party candidate for Congress in Illinois' 15th district. What was perhaps most surprising was the unstated but common assumption that I was somehow trespassing, invading territory that by rights belonged to political professionals. Republicans and Democrats, no others need apply. It was though I had set out to practice medicine without a license. People working hard to overcome Illinois' prohibitive requirements for signed petitions for a third party to get on the ballot were told to leave property, public and private. You can't do that here. Media outlets that formerly employed me suddenly seemed to think that it was wrong, unfair, to do so. I could apparently talk and write about politics all I wanted, on the condition that I not try to do anything about it, such as run for office. Democracy means that you have a chance to get together with others on an equal basis, not just as an audience, to get the information you need and take decisions that actually change things. To pull a lever every 2 or 4 years, or even less frequently, for one or the other of two carefully preselected candidates is not democracy. Suppose one wanted to vote against the Bush administration's murderous intentions towards Iraq in this election just passed. Whom did one vote for? Both self-described major parties supported the war. America has a one-party system, asserted the late African leader Jules Nyerere. With your usual exuberance, you have two of them, he said, perhaps overgenerously. And that was Democracy or Corporations, Meditations from Chomsky, written by Carl Estabrook of the University of Illinois and published last winter in the Counterpunch newsletter.
You got a penthouse in the city and another home in the hills. You got a corner office on the 51st floor and you walk on a carpet made of $100 bills. Well, I look at you up there in your plush office chair, and I wonder what is going through your brain. As you look outside your window, watch the people moving by below. You must be thinking about your capital gains. Now you look me in the eye and tell me exactly what it is you do. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that you make your money from the grueling work that other people do. While they're slaving away in fields and factories, you're sipping your coffee on Madison Avenue. Should I call you evil? Should I call you cruel? Did you just come from the right family and go to all the right schools? Tell me, what do you think? Does it feed your soul? Cause the life you are making for us is spinning out of control. You tell me this is fair. You tell me that they'll get their share. You say that you worked hard to get there. But I'm asking if you see from that tinted window in the air how many people be poor so you can be a billionaire. You say this is the way it has to be competitive in the economy. Poverty is a market incentive to keep people from being lazy. And I say to you, if you believe that shit they taught you in school, you must be crazy. Sometimes it makes me angry. Sometimes I lie. Working all their lives for nothing, they'll be working until they die. Should I call you evil? Should I call you cruel? Did you just come from the right family and go to all the right schools? Tell me, what do you think of your life? Does it feed your soul? Choice between Coke and Pepsi. So don't tell us your free markets will satisfy our needs. Don't tell us that what's good for Monsanto is good for me. You rob us of our livelihoods and our grandmother's seeds. Your endless thirst for profit is a social disease. Should I call you? Just come from the right family and go to all the right schools. Tell me, what do you think of life? Does it feed your soul? Cause the life you are making for us is spinning. Spinning
What of the success promised to those who play by the rules and don't challenge them? The essay I'm about to read you captures how empty that victory can be. It's called We Possessed, and was written by Adam Engel and published on May 6th in Dissonant Voice. The possessed man is not bad, nor is he good. He is terrified, alone, even among friends and family. He works to support his family, but he's not sure exactly what the hell he does. According to his job description, he administrates creative product strategies. Well, well. The health insurance covers his wife, who also works, and their two kids, both under 7 years of age, and subject to all manner of illness, injury, and disease. Then there were the expensive pregnancies themselves, and the drugs he must take daily to function at his job without drinking to excess or veering into violence or bursting into tears. True, he's covered by the company plan, but loopholes open and money falls through. Deductibles, co-payments, fine print scams. He's no longer interested in his friends, the few that he maintained since school, or in having friends at all. What good are they except to drink with, and he's not supposed to drink while on his pills, though he does anyway. And don't think this is all confidential, that they don't know, the they at the company, whoever they might be, that he sees a head drugger to stay on top of things. He's 37 and still paying his student loans. Graduate program at the university, MBA, had to do it. Or else, how would he have climbed to even his middling position on the ladder? He's reached his final rung. He knows he hasn't the energy to kill, the will that would enable him to climb further. In fact, the remaining energies of his life will be directed towards hanging on to the rung on which his life is precariously perched. He must maintain his station on the limitless ladder to the sky. He can barely see the people at the bottom. But he would need quite a powerful telescope indeed to even glimpse the stars at the top. The kids will want to go to college. His wife, also a mediocrity, but in a different position at a different firm, a different profession, will grow stronger, as women tend to do after 50, after the sex and procreation, after the body, just when he is starting to collapse. Rapid rise from 20 to 40. Slow descent, then at 50, the rolling tumble. Unless you're at the top of the ladder, in which case 50 is not 50, due to special treatments, physical training, private cooks, drugs, vitamins, surgeries. He's reached the end of things, he knows, but he must see things through at least until the kids are out of school. But of course, college won't be enough. It wasn't for him. He needed a master's. His kids will need PhDs. He worries that somehow the system will fail him. It has not failed him to this point, merely placed him at his rightful place in the hierarchy. But he fears that the system, based on protocols, laws, unwritten rules, tacit agreements, and technologies that he can never hope to understand, will collapse of its own weight and intricacy. He does not understand how the network works, or how food gets to the supermarkets, or how the parent company trickles his paycheck down the pyramid of subsidiaries and holding companies and through his department and into his bank account. He does not understand the high level of partnership between the bank and the corporation that owns it, which is the parent of the company he works for, and where he will spend his days before being traded or shuffled off in some arcane corporate deal or merger, or is fired outright, laid off. And then what? Sending out resumes as he'd done as a kid fresh out of college, and as a young married man with his expensive MBA? He fears limited resources, so he does not read the hard copy of the city news, but browses the paper's site on the network. But when does he have time to read this, working 9 to 5 as he does, which is not 9 to 5 at all, but 8 to 6, 7, sometimes 10 o'clock? By which point he is exhausted, despite his clockwork consumption of caffeine and nicotine. And when he does browse the news on the network, he realizes how small he and his life are, even in the context of the corporation, not to mention the role of the company in international affairs. Good God! The corporation is everywhere, in every country. Many of these countries are at war with each other, and if the corporation's interests are seriously threatened, they might go to war against the nation. But the nation is already at war. He is glad that the nation possesses the most well-trained, technologically advanced military on the planet. He had not gone to the last war, for he was in graduate school. But the current war terrifies him. The destruction the nation wreaks upon its challenger, with missiles paid for with his tax money. He has been extremely nervous since the current war began. But he does not doubt that after the slaughter, the citizens will be treated to parades and celebrations on television, and he will watch flag-waving marchers outside his office window. He is neither angry nor satisfied with the affairs of the nation any more than he is or could be with the machinations of the company. It is all beyond his ken. He is, if not happy, grateful to be able to rise each morning, take his pills, and begin the commute to his job, and arrive at his job, no matter how demanding, no matter how trivial, no matter how wasteful of his time on earth. The countless meetings, the talk, the talky-talk-talk, the assignments from superiors that he organizes and delegates to his subordinates. Often he finds himself with nothing to do, no actual work, but virtual work, deadlines planned for the future, the possibility of truckloads of data hanging over his head. So he spends many hours, those not spent, attending meetings, creating plans and memos and scenarios for the monstrous jobs, the impossible tasks to come. He is attracted to his wife. They go to the gym together. He forces himself to go to the gym, not to postpone the inevitable descent, but to make the landing smoother. He's seen many a man crash, but he doesn't have the same kind of energy for his wife, not like he used to, maybe once a week, if that. And of course, she has her work too, and they are both busy with the children. He feels, given the uncertainty of the world, that he should own a gun, at least a rifle. The police exist to protect his property, not his family. Anyway, they are always somewhere when you need them, but seldom here, where they could save your life if so inclined. But he is confused by the city's Byzantine gun laws, and he's not comfortable letting the government know he has a weapon. Should the government turn for the worse, the gun owners in the database will be the first ones visited by the police. But he fears being caught with an illegal weapon, a mandatory jail term, and the end of his career and all he'd strive for. Only those outside the system can own unregistered weapons with impunity. Truly, he would rather be dead. He might live another 40 years. 40 years of this, maybe 50. Another reason to own a gun. He can think of no better way to exit. Effective drugs are as illegal as guns, and the medications the head drugger prescribes won't kill him. Worse, they might put him to sleep, and he'd be caught holding the bag or pill bottle trying to escape a federal crime. He worked too hard for too long to lose it that way. If he must exit this earth, he will buy a gun. On the black market, what and wherever that is, if he makes a decision, it will not matter that his corpse is found holding an illegal weapon. Of course, if he gets caught in the act before pulling the trigger or chickens out, they will send him away to an institution. Again, that would ruin him. Of course, this is all hypothetical, daydream talk. He has a deep responsibility to his family, his children. His is the kind of ethic that was instilled in his subconscious forcefully, frequently, and early on. It is so part of his psyche that he cannot even attempt to fathom it, just accept it, passively, silently, albeit reluctantly. Nevertheless, he does think critically about his children. He wonders aloud to himself, of course, if he actually loves them. His own childhood seems both distant and parallel. That is, he often feels mired in his own childhood and resents the adult paternal role he must play. Also, he feels sorry for his children and fears for them. He does not understand the structure of the world outside his home and office cubicle, but he believes it is heading for a fall, collapse, chaos. What then? What if his children? What right had he and his wife to yank them from the peace of cosmic nothingness and thrust them into time and consciousness against their will? And I have been reading We Possessed by Adam Engel, published in Dissident Voice on May 6th, 2003.
I have heard in beautiful cities, in the land far from the blessed, but the only cities that I've ever known, we get no rest. I have heard in beautiful mansions far up in the azure sky, but the only mansions that I've ever known are not for you or I. I have heard in beautiful stories of times that are going to be, but the only times that I've ever known were bad for you and me. I have heard of beautiful countries far off the land of the dead, in the only countries that I've ever known, poor and hungry lack bread. I have heard in beautiful garments to be worn by the fighters of sin, but the only garments that I've ever known in winter terribly thin. Hearing these beautiful things in the land beyond. cities, far off in the land of the blessed. But in the only cities that I've ever known, the poor and the hungry lack rest.
Dick Flax is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and is on the board of the Santa Barbara County Action Network. He's been involved in social movements since the 1960s when he helped found the Students for a Democratic Society. He spoke in February on the history of repression in wartime.
I was thinking about what to say because I'm not a lawyer and I'm not able really to give expert analysis of the legal picture now. But it occurred to me that understanding what is happening now is enriched, in fact, importantly so, by looking a bit at the history of U.S. government responses to threats and alleged threats in times of social conflict and war. There are a number of things that many of us, including myself, tend to assume at the present moment. For example, if the target of repression are non-citizen Muslims and Arabs, it's possible to be in a state of relative denial about the impact of these measures on the rest of us. So one look at history is to suggest, and I'll tell you this in advance, that always in the past, the processes have started with a highly targeted group and then poisoned the climate of free expression for most of the rest of the country by the time that cycle was over. Second, the sense is that people like Ashcroft and Cheney and Bush and others are right-wing zealots, and therefore the measures they have taken come from a right-wing agenda. The history suggests that most of the major repressive moves of the past were sponsored by liberal presidents and even liberal organizations. And so we will need to face that history because I think it contains certain kinds of warnings. The third thing I think to say about understanding the present is that the proposals that we've heard about and the actions we've heard about are not motivated primarily by an effort to stop terrorism, but are motivated by an effort to increase the police power of the state. And that process has been going on for a long time. We could look at the entire sweep of American history and, as was mentioned, go back to the Alien Sedition Act of 1798. I'm not going to do that whole sweep, but just to mention that those Alien Sedition Acts under the Adams administration were created to criminalize the behavior of those who supported the French Revolution, including Thomas Jefferson, because the French Revolution was a dire threat to American values and the American way of life, according to those who promulgated that act. The 19th century is filled with periods of repression resulting from not just the Civil War, but intense social conflicts in which among the people perceived as the greatest threats, the sources of evil, were anarchists who were accused of and sometimes guilty of advocating and indeed perpetrating terrorism. And certain acts like the famous Haymarket Square bombing of 1886 led to a tremendous wave of repression directed at all those who were active in the struggle of labor and other social movements at that time. I won't even look at this history, although it's important. I want to start with World War I because I think a lot of what is happening today can be directly traced to some of what happened at that time. President Wilson, a liberal president, a Democratic president, party president, signed the Espionage Act of 1917, which gave the federal government, among other things, the right to prosecute those who impeded the war effort by questioning it, or of urging resistance to the draft and other measures of the war. During that year of the war, 900 people at least were incarcerated under the Espionage Act, most famously Eugene Victor Debs, the great leader of the Socialist Party, who went to a jail to empathize and express solidarity with other socialists who'd been incarcerated, gave a speech in Canton, in Ohio, for which he was arrested and convicted of violating the act and sentenced to jail for 5 years for a speech. Debs got 1 million votes for president while he was incarcerated. The Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, the Wobblies, they were considered a dire threat to American society because they advocated sabotage, or were charged with so advocating, and they were charged, many Wobblies were charged with specific crimes over the course of that organization's life. Even though they didn't oppose World War I, all their offices were raided, their leaders rounded up, and several leaders sentenced to jail for 20-year terms under the Espionage Act of 1917. The organization was virtually destroyed as a result of that kind of government repression. The fear levels during World War I, then, of domestic terrorism in the hands of radicals, on the part of radicals, as well as Germans, was certainly heightened after the war by the Soviet Revolution. If you put together the domestic class struggle and the so-called anarchist tactics of some groups within the labor movement, the fact that there had been assassinations, murders, bombings, and so forth in the course of that struggle, and then add to that the Soviet Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, led by Lenin and Trotsky and others who proclaimed world revolution as their goal, you can see the context within which in 1918 and 1919, new measures would be taken or contemplated by the federal government because of the dire threat that so was presented. And in 1919, there were a number of inflammatory things that happened. Great strikes in Seattle, which closed the entire port. A steel strike, one of the greatest strikes in American history, that closed the steel industry. And many other acts, including a series of bombings, one of which bombed the home of Attorney General Palmer, Wilson's Attorney General. And just to remind you what the Palmer raids briefly were about, so Attorney General Palmer, having had his home bombed, declared there was a domestic terrorist threat, that it was rooted in immigrant aliens, non-citizens, 250 Russian immigrants, including Emma Goldman, were rounded up in December of 1919 and immediately deported to the Soviet Union. And then, a couple of months later, 4,000 persons were rounded up all over the country, and this sounds very reminiscent of today, held in seclusion for long periods of time, brought into secret hearings, and ordered deported. That was one, this is a quote from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. I saw on Pat Buchanan's website, he praised the Palmer raids. He said Palmer had the right idea. The source of domestic terrorism, according to Buchanan, is always alien immigrants, always the result of immigration waves. We need a new Palmer raid led by our current Attorney General. He called for that, and we had it. Spring of 1920, a typesetter and anarchist named Andrea Salcedo, an immigrant, was arrested in New York by FBI agents and held for 8 weeks in the FBI offices on the 14th floor of the Park Row building, not allowed to contact family, friends, or lawyers. Sounds like the case of Jose Padillo, which we haven't mentioned tonight, very similar circumstances. Then his crushed body was found on the pavement below the building, and the FBI said he had committed suicide by jumping from the 14th floor window. That, just an example, a flavor of 1919-1920 period, out of which came the organization we call the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The person who named and identified those to be rounded up in the Palmer raids was a 24-year-old official named J. Edgar Hoover. And Hoover was appointed in 1924 to recreate the Government Intelligence Division, clean it up. It had been subject to a variety of criticisms. And in the aftermath of the Red Scare that I've just described, it seemed a very appropriate thing to do. Now, Hoover was brilliant. He must have been to stay in office for something like 50 years. Brilliant in many ways as a manipulator of both public opinion and public officials. And one of the things that he did in the first dozen years of the FBI was not to go after domestic political dissent, but to go after crime, organized crime, create an image of the federal police as very effective, the G-men, during the Prohibition period, cracking down on that source of danger to American society. But in 1936, he had a meeting with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, progressive liberal president. Roosevelt was concerned about the German threat. There were Nazis operating in the United States. There was Nazi espionage. There was clearly plans by the German government, by Hitler, to subvert the United States. He said, I need the FBI to focus attention on this kind of threat. And Hoover said, you know, you're forgetting the communists. He said, if you look at what the communists are doing, and after all, the Soviet Union is also a foreign power, they're organizing labor in strategic industries. There are communists running unions on the longshoremen, on the docks of the West Coast. There are communists in key strategic defense plants. We need to target them. So Roosevelt said, fine, and in a totally secret authorization, authorize the collection and surveillance and collection of information on both fascists and communists. That's the start of the FBI's program of systematically monitoring American citizens as well as non-citizens, but particularly American citizens who the FBI regarded as communists. No legal authorization other than Roosevelt's basically secret order was provided initially. And in just a few years, hundreds of thousands of files were opened on Americans of various stripes that the FBI considered, for one reason or another, threatening. Even, and by World War II, I think literally millions of files, mostly of left-wingers, finally came into existence. Now, here's my point. The FBI then developed a vested interest in the surveillance and control of domestic radicalism. The budget of the FBI depended on the existence of the threat. The activities of the FBI were shaped by that threat. The FBI used methods, including placing undercover agents within these organizations in various parts of the country. Supposedly, one out of five communists were actually FBI agents. The FBI systematically and illegally wiretapped people, engaged in the sneak and peek, breaking and entering kinds of tactics, all unauthorized, but directed at these threatening persons who were listed in their files, even during World War II. There's a lot more history of this. The FBI, in fact, I think we need more detailed history than we may have of trying to understand this development. But I wanted to talk about a couple of other episodes in the post-World War period, what we call the period of McCarthyism. I'm not going to trace how that came into being, but suffice to say that this FBI apparatus had a lot to do with creating a political framework to enable two things to happen, that the domestic communist threat would be the number one domestic issue in America. That was one goal. And secondly, that the Communist Party would be criminalized and all who were said to adhere to or relate to it would be able to be treated as criminals. That was the goal. It was largely achieved in 1950, the second goal, by the passage of the McCarran Act, the Internal Security Act of 1950. That act stated, and the idea was definitely embodied in it, that we were in a life and death struggle with the Soviet Union and its bloc, a godless, diabolical movement that sought to impose a dictatorship over the whole planet. That is the findings of Congress and the prevailing belief at the time. It is no more severe than the terrorist threat is supposed to be today. It is just similar to it. That is, there was a fundamental threat in the world to us, and not only a kind of military threat, but a deeper kind of evil threat. And this movement had agents here in the U.S. This was J. Edgar Hoover's view from probably back to the Palmer raids, and it's certainly something that he promulgated publicly as well as with many meetings and dialogues with many people, and many others had this view as well. President Truman, liberal Democrat, adopted in 1947 a loyalty program to investigate more than 2 million federal employees to find out if any had communist affiliations. I think out of those 2 million, about 500 were identified as communists, none of them, of course, with any espionage intention, but that was the loyalty program of Truman, adopted in part, why? To deflect criticism or accept the recommendations of the FBI, deflect criticisms from the FBI and its allies that we were doing nothing about the threat. In 1950, to skip a good deal of history, the act I mentioned before. Conservative senators had proposed a law, including Richard Nixon in the House and Senator Mundt in the Senate, had proposed a bill that would have required the registration of all organizations the Attorney General designated as communist or communist-related, and the registration of all who were members of those organizations. And if the organizations themselves refused to register, you as a member had to register on pain of criminal prosecution. Well, the liberals in the Senate didn't like this bill. They felt it was likely to chill freedom of speech, that seemed to violate the Constitution in a number of ways, including the right not to incriminate yourself. But they were very afraid of opposing the bill, just as liberals in this Congress have been afraid of opposing strong repressive measures against terrorists. So they came up with their own idea. This idea was to allow the FBI to identify those it considered to be security risks to be rounded up in a national emergency and detained without trial. That was a bill sponsored by Senator Hubert Humphrey, Paul Douglas of Illinois, Herbert Lehman of New York, and other liberal heroes. This was an alternative to registration. Senator McCarran quite cleverly said, that's a great idea too, we'll put it all together. And the entire measure was adopted in 1950, criminalizing the Communist Party and allowing the FBI to identify and create an index, a list of persons who could be rounded up in a national emergency for detention. It was called the Security Index. It lasted through the 1960s. When I got my FBI trial files, I found I was on it. Perhaps some number of you, without knowing it, were on it. It didn't happen, the concentration camps, although 10 sites were in fact selected for such detention. I think maybe the liberals thought their draconian measure was so crazy it wouldn't pass. And at the same time, they'd get credit for being tougher than the conservatives on this threat. That was the particular outcome of that. Now, the ACLU, during this period, did virtually nothing. I want everyone here who's not a member of the ACLU to join it and become active in it. However, there's a bitter set of lessons from the McCarthy period that we need to absorb. The ACLU was being targeted and tarnished and branded as a communist organization by the FBI and other conservative forces. One of its board members in the late 30s was an extremely well-known Communist Party leader named Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. She'd been an activist back in the beginning of the 20th century, a well-known kind of heroine of the class struggle. In 1939, the ACLU leadership asked her to step down from the board because, well, politically she was a liability given this climate that was building up. They said, if you support Stalin and the Soviet Union, you can't really be a sincere civil libertarian. They passed a rule that said, at that time, it said no one who supports dictatorship in other countries can be on the board of the ACLU. And she refused to get off, so there was a trial of her, and finally she was removed. After the war, several ACLU leaders came to the conclusion that the ACLU had to make a very sharp distinction between itself and communism. Not only did they pass, which may well have been very appropriate, strong criticisms and critique of the Soviet Union and Stalin, they decided that no one who supported the Soviet Union or was a communist or would not renounce their Communist Party membership should be a member of the ACLU. And that, of course, led to a considerable internal struggle in the ACLU because some of its board members and active members, in fact, a large portion of its leadership, did not like these proposals, one of whose authors was Norman Thomas, the author of the Anti-Communist Moves. One of the leading board members at the time, Morris Ernst, we've only learned recently, had a personal relationship with J. Edgar Hoover. He wanted Hoover to tell him who in the ACLU membership were communists, and he was willing to cooperate with the FBI in getting rid of the communist threat. This, he thought, I assume, was good politics at the time. So the ACLU did not lend its legal support, did not provide counsel. For example, when the Communist Party leadership was tried under the Smith Act for advocating the overthrow of the government. Conspiring to teach and advocate the overthrow of the government. They were not charged with violent acts, they were charged with speech. They did not act very forcibly against any of the major measures during the McCarthy period. Even when a board member, Corliss Lamont, took on Senator McCarthy in particular ways, they refused to support him because Lamont had been one of those who opposed the various policy moves by the ACLU. It's a snapshot of a time that is very disturbing to look back on in retrospect. But the caveat is this, that is, if we decide there is a targetable group of people whose civil liberties we are not going to try to protect because they really are dangerous to the country and to us in various ways, and political prudence says we should step away from their defense, we run the risk of what did happen in the McCarthy period, the tremendous elaboration of police state capabilities by the FBI, as well as the passage of these legislation, the purging of hundreds of people from all kinds of institutions, and a great many tragedies that many of you are familiar with in terms of the free expression of ideas. We're still living with that period in many ways. The immaturity of our politics can be traced back to the continuing belief in the evil, unmitigated evil that was represented in our minds by the Communist Party or in the minds of the United States. Now, briefly with respect to the Vietnam War, the FBI had built up its power against the Communist Party and related groups. It now had a tremendous machinery by the time the 60s got going. And one of the things to learn about the existence of this kind of police state apparatus or secret police apparatus is that presidents are tempted to use it against not threats to national security, but political threats to themselves. J. Edgar Hoover played on that by combinations of blackmail of presidents. He knew stuff about Kennedy and Johnson, for example, that they didn't want out, so there was a kind of blackmail. But also in return, he offered to help them. He went to Bobby Kennedy in 1964 and said, you know, the civil rights movement is on the rise. Communists are operating in it. The closest aide to Martin Luther King is a known communist. Robert Kennedy authorized J. Edgar Hoover to engage in a systematic campaign of surveillance of Martin Luther King, which led to the efforts to blackmail King because of alleged sexual misbehavior that the FBI allegedly had gathered on him. Threatening letters were sent to King under FBI auspices. It was a very dirty campaign, but Hoover could always say, I think, it was authorized by the Kennedys. In 1967, as ghetto riots emerged, President Johnson and his Attorney General Ramsey Clark were disturbed. Ramsey Clark wrote a memorandum ordering the FBI to use the maximum resources, investigative intelligence, to collect and report all facts bearing upon the question as to whether there has been a scheme or conspiracy by any group of whatever size effectiveness, or affiliation to plan, promote, or aggravate riot activity. And he went on to mention, as part of this organization, of what needs to be looked at, getting sources or informants in black nationalist groups, SNCC, and other less publicized groups to be developed. Ramsey Clark, who's now our great hero of outspokenness against the war in Iraq and other things, ordered the FBI to do a complete and detailed surveillance of the civil rights movement in 1967. President Johnson that same year decided that the anti-war protests were motivated, sourced in the Soviet Union and China, and he asked and demanded that the FBI provide him evidence. The result of both of those orders was the creation of new counterintelligence programs, COINTELPRO, in which the FBI felt itself having the right to target thousands of leaders and activists in civil rights and anti-war groups, to invade their homes, to wiretap them, to send letters to their employers, anonymous letters claiming that they were national security threats and detailing these, engaging in a variety of undercover acts, trying to foment disagreements, trying to literally decide who should be leaders of various organizations and so forth. It's a very amazing history of several years in which the FBI felt authorized to enter the social movements of the United States, not only for surveillance purposes, but without warrant, without due process, to engage in destructive acts against those movements. And it's really not until the Watergate scandals that the whistle began to be blown and the evidence began to be revealed about these entirely secret operations. In the post-Watergate environment, under a Republican administration of Gerald Ford, the restraints on the FBI and the CIA were adopted, which have now been, as far as I can tell, totally obliterated. That did prevent, or at least claim to prevent, many of these activities. I'm not saying that since then the FBI has been a model of civil liberties enforcement, but one of the lessons is that the temptation of having a police apparatus like this was not resisted by persons we might otherwise regard as liberal heroes or as people we would prefer to see in office than Richard Nixon or Gerald Ford and so forth. I think the problem with a discussion like this tonight is that it can depress us, it can make us fearful. That's not the lesson. The lesson is if we maintain our rights to speak out, if we support structures like the ACLU and local organizations seeking change, if we make our views known, it's very hard to impose this kind of fear regime. We've got to adopt the ACLU current position, which says we can be free and safe, understand what those provisions are, study them, talk to and work with everyone in the community, including our local officials, and there are people here, getting them to opt out of these programs wherever possible. Thank you.
That was Professor Dick Flax of the University of California speaking last February on repression in wartime. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. For the last hour of the program, we're pleased to present a radio drama, The Investigator. Its author was himself blacklisted during the McCarthy era.